Thank you. Good afternoon. There's all these little microphones coming out of the ceiling. Did you notice that? Being recorded? I don't know. I'm really blessed. We're blessed with music here, and we got a trumpet most every time we sing. And I just wanted to let you know that when we one of the places we visit, some weeks when we're not here, on occasion we go down to Columbia, and that might be one of the only other congregations where there's also a trumpet. Matt Deviney plays trumpet along with the accompaniment there, so it's really nice. So I'm spoiled. I just get trumpet everywhere I go, and it's nice. Okay, I've been promising you this sermon for quite a while. You're finally going to get it, or it's not an it, it's more than one. But those who like titles, the short version would be Women in New Testament Times. The longer version would be what is it like to be a woman in New Testament Times? What was it like to be a woman in New Testament Times? And, you know, when we read the Bible or any other piece of ancient literature, it's easy to be anachronistic. That is, it's easy for us to take our current circumstances or what we know about the world now or maybe the world, you know, in recent history and project it back onto the past and assume that the circumstances back then were in some way similar to what we experience now. We project our world onto the Bible. Sometimes that's okay, sometimes it's not. If you want to turn, don't turn there, but Matthew 20 in verse 2, where it talks about these people working all day for a penny. If you have a King James, it says they worked all day for a penny. And you may think, well, you would work all day for just something that you can't buy anything with because a penny's not worth anything. And, you know, you could go into this whole big idea of reasoning based on what a penny means in America in 2013, which has nothing to do with what a pence was in 1611 when King James was translated, nor does it have anything to do with what the original words were in the Greek a long time ago. So by putting our own perspective back on the Bible, we could come to some wrong conclusions. On the other hand, some things were the same. People were people. They grew, they were born, they grew up, they got married, they had children, they died, they had to have a place to live, they ate, and they had many of the same concerns that we have today. So human beings have always been human beings, so that's the same. But nonetheless, we have to be careful when we read something that was written a long time ago, that we understand it in its context. And those of you that are here regularly know this has been an interest of mine for at least the past 10 years or so. So I like to research and learn as much as I can about the times that and the way they were during the period of time that the Bible was written. And I've shared a lot of that research with you and what I've learned. And today I want to begin a series. I'm calling it a series because it's going to be at least two sermons. It could be three. It depends on how fast it goes. And what I'd like to look at is the lives of women during the first century of the present era, the time when the New Testament was written. Specifically, I'd like to look at the women of the Roman Empire. We're not going to be looking at how women lived in India or China or somewhere else. But we'll look at women in the Roman Empire, in the Hellenistic culture, and specifically in the area of Palestine, you know, Judah and Galilee and so forth, which was the area of Jesus' ministry. Also in doing that, I don't have it in my notes here, but we will obviously talk about the Roman Empire more in general because Paul's travels took him out away from the area of Judea and into different cultures. So, but they were still, it was still a Roman culture, or more specifically, you would say a Greek culture. It was the Roman Empire, but it was Greek culture. And we'll learn a little bit about that. As we learn a thing or two about women's lives during this period, we'll use that information as we go along to perhaps fine-tune our understanding of certain verses in the Bible, or perhaps in some cases broaden our perspective a little bit and think, well, maybe it's not the way I always thought. I know I've come to several examples of that where I had, you know, pretty sure what something meant, and now I'm not so sure anymore. So I'll share that with you, because as we understand the context of the writings, then the writings start to make more sense. Before I get started, I want to make several comments. One is that the sources, the original sources, are not that plentiful. We don't have huge libraries full of texts from the first century in Judea. You know, we have some, and we can look at those, and perhaps come to some conclusions, but we still have to be careful. You have to be cautious when your sampling size is small, and you read that, and you say, oh, well, this is the way everybody must have been. Well, maybe not, because you only have one source, or maybe you only have two sources. So we always need to be careful. Just because I may quote something to you that was written 2,000 years ago, that may have been something was only practice right here, or something that somebody made up, worse yet. So we have to be careful, and the more sources we have, the better. And also, we have to realize that if anybody here, you don't need to raise your hand, anybody watch the news, anybody watch Fox or some, you got the conservatives, you have the liberals. If you listen to, as people that work for me do, around noontime, they listen to this conservative talk radio, and this guy gets on there and runs his mouth, and you probably like him, I'm not going to put him down, but he just goes on and on about all kinds of things. One of the things he does is he uses hyperbole. He exaggerates to make a point. Okay, and so does that's what people do in communicating today. We exaggerate to make a point. Well, it was no different 2,000 years ago. Because we come up with a source and somebody makes a point, you have to realize, you have to understand their context also. They may have been arguing about this in order to make a point about something else, the same way we do now. So those are a few caveats that when you look at history, you can't just pick up something and say, oh, it says this must be the way it was. Well, no, maybe that's some commentator on their Fox network of the day, in a sense, making a point about something and exaggerating to make that point, or going to an extreme to say, oh, this is, to make a point about something else. So all of those things are possible. So that's just a caution in general. When we look at history, we don't just grab a source and say, this has to be the way it always was. That's not a safe way to look at history. One of the sources I will be using, it's not a primary source. I didn't go get the papyri and so forth. But this is a book called Women in the World of the Earliest Christians. It's by Lynn Kohick. And she has looked at a lot of the original sources and quotes them. There are other books that would be probably equally good that I have not read. And I did consult with other ones as well. But I will be reading some of the quotes from her, as well as some things that she's quoting from the original sources. Okay, that's just to get started. Today, what I'm going to try to look at is daughters, marriage, and maybe we'll make it to motherhood. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll get partway through motherhood. In the future, we'll look at religious activities that women participated in, the work that they did, as well as the influence that women had and the idea of patronage, which was very, very important in Roman society. We will talk about that a little bit today, but we'll talk about it more in the future. Okay, what was it like to be a woman in the time of the New Testament? Do you care what it was like to be a woman? Well, I hope you care, just because if you're reading this book, it'll make more sense to you if you understand a little bit about what their lives were like. Now, having said that, I'm not going to talk a lot about what home life was like. We've already talked about that. We've had sermons that I've given before. It talks about what it's like to be a child in the time of Jesus, where we talked about the average size of the houses there in Judea, what life was like, how poor they were, what type of a life they lived, the animals and the context of the society around them and so forth. We've talked about a lot of that. I'm not going to go over that same territory again. I'll try to add to that. But keep that in mind. Those of you that have heard the sermons, if you haven't, they're on the website probably. You can listen to them or do your own research. But it's good to there's a certain amount of context that many of you should already have by having heard me speak in the past. And I'm going to focus specifically on today on what it was like to be a daughter, what it was like to be growing up and having your family expecting you to get married and so forth, and how that all was. First of all, I want to talk about being born a daughter. And it may sound like a boring subject. Perhaps it will be. I don't know. We'll find out in a minute. But it's not as simple as it might sound. And it might be surprising to some of you. Maybe it won't be surprising. I don't know. I'm going to start by boring you by reading quotes, but that's the best I can do with this particular. I'm going to read various quotes from the book. And just bear with me, because it's she words it better than I could in some occasions. First of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like to be born a girl and what that meant and what your chances in life were based on that reality just right there. And this may surprise you. All right, this is from the chapter entitled Women as Daughters. And it says, the power of the father is perhaps nowhere as apparent in his role in accepting or rejecting his child at birth. In a quasi-official ceremony, the child would be placed before the father, and if he lifted it up from the ground, he signaled his willingness to accept responsibility for rearing the child. If he did not pick up the newborn, it was cast out of the family. The same power was held by slave owners over their slaves' children. Mothers who were not in a licit marriage, I'll explain that in a little bit, who were not in a licit marriage, which meant the child was not legally responsibility of the father, could decide themselves whether or not to raise their baby. If a wife was divorced or widowed while pregnant, the baby when born would be raised or rejected by her husband's family. If the newborn was rejected, it was either killed directly or exposed. In the latter, it might be rescued and raised by someone else, usually as their slave, or die from the elements and animals. The father himself did not actually place the child outside the house. This would be done by another household member, perhaps the slave or the mother. There is no record as to how the person abandoning the child would feel. We can only guess that emotions would at best be neutral, at worst devastating. Although exposure, that's the term for this, although exposure was technically not the same as infanticide, historians debate how many exposed infants lived through their childhood. Certainly the risk was great that abandoning the child would lead to its death. If you were born a girl, there's a good chance you might not live to see, you know, a week or two. That's very possible. It's also possible if you were a guy, if you were born a boy. Either way. It's just that the reality was boys were more desired than girls. And that was just part of the culture then. I'm going to talk about that for a little while. And actually, well, I won't tip my hand. It's not as ancient as you might think. It's not only ancient. From page 40, the same chapter. It is commonplace to suggest that females were exposed more frequently than males. A 4th century BC Greek comic poet opines, however you say that word, everyone raises a son even if he's poor, but exposes a daughter even if he is rich. So that was the common wisdom. A note written in 1 BC from a husband to his pregnant wife reveals this sentiment had not changed in the intervening 300 years. The husband is working in Alexandria. So I'm interjecting into the quote here. This is an actual, I'm going to read you an actual quote from a letter that still is in existence. Somebody writing to his pregnant wife, and he's working out of town. In the Roman Empire, there was a lot of freedom of travel, freedom to go elsewhere and work, and also communication. In some ways, it was very modern. The husband's working in Alexandria. He reassures his wife that all is well with him and that he will send his... Oh, I thought it was a quote. Yeah, I do have some quote, sorry. And that he will send his pay home to her over in wherever it is. I don't know how this... Oxyrhynchus or something like that. Something that's about 200 miles up the Nile. Then he notes, this is a quote, translated, if you have the baby before I return, if it is a boy, let it live. If it is a girl, expose it. That's an exact quote from his letter. While literary and epigraphic evidence suggests that more girls were exposed than boys, the ratio is difficult to determine. For example, both Suetonius and Quintilian note specific cases where boys are exposed and do not mention girls directly, although they are likely to be included when the authors speak of groups of children. Yet few would argue that this evidence shows more boys than girls were exposed. More likely, the fate of boys was more interesting to ancient authors. Overall, it seems social sentiment indicated that sons were a better family investment for a host of reasons, and thus limited resources would be funneled in the direction of raising male children. Okay, that's sad, isn't it? A little reality there. The world was not a good place then, not that it is now. Now, understand that this is we're reading about Rome right now. So it was a Roman custom. It was not a Jewish custom. Philo and Josephus both equate abortion and infanticide with murder. Way back then, they did. The practice sounds barbaric to us today, doesn't it? I read that, and you think, oh, I guess you thought that. I read that, and I think, oh, it's terrible. How horrible things were back then. This week in New York Times, maybe it was last week, and you've all heard about in India, the terrible rape that happened there on the, I think it was on a bus or something, and the attitudes. I'm going to read a little bit about that in a minute. But in India, this is according to the New York Times, 100,000 women are burned to death each year by husbands or families. Another 125,000 die from injuries inflicted in domestic violence that's never reported to police. Now, there's a lot of people in India, but here we are in the 21st century, and we're killing our female children in this world. For in India, it's because of quote-unquote honor and other things like that. It's crazy. So before we think it was too awful back then, and it was, let's not let ourselves off the hook. From Tehelka in India, an article by Shoma Chadbury. Most Indian men still think that women are fair game for sexual violence. As part of the national soul searching following the horrific gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old pharmacy student on a Delhi bus, we have interviewed scores of men from all walks of life, farmers, lawyers, Hindus, Muslims, young and old. Predictably, most men from rural areas said that girls had too much freedom and should not be out at night. I won't read the whole thing. Basically, in India, there's still an attitude that if you're out there, you deserve what you get. And that's why there's 225,000 that they know about every year being killed. Because of a male-dominated society that doesn't value the life of women. So before we get too hard on our ancestors and on people in the ancient world, let's realize it's still pretty bad. In fact, we have more sophisticated ways of doing it, don't we? There are roughly 210 million pregnancies a year. But there's only about 160 million births in the world. Over 40 million abortions a year. So this idea of getting rid of children that are inconvenient for us is nothing new. Or it's nothing new, but it's still here also. It was practiced in the ancient world. It's still practiced today. Sometimes for the same reasons, economic reasons, social reasons. Sometimes, you want a boy, not a girl. You're in China, you're only allowed to have one, supposedly. Back in the day, if you were in a rural area, you were only allowed to have one child, supposedly. If that child happened to be a girl, sometimes that child was eliminated. That, for your own information, when we were in China, we had contracted with a guy who had his own car to take us on a day trip to see the Great Wall. He was from the city, and he was an only child. But his wife had like four or five sisters and brothers because she was from the country, and they didn't enforce that policy in the rural areas, figuring that you needed help to work on the farm. Let's get back to the Roman Empire. I just wanted to make the point that before we're too harsh on the people 2,000 years ago, it's really we're still the same today. And in that way, humans haven't changed very much, unfortunately. Infanticide was common in the ancient world. The idea of killing children that you didn't want to have. As horrible as that sounds, that's the way it was. I'm not saying in Jewish culture. It was not common in Jewish culture, thank God. But it was common in the world overall. Even if you study your history in the Americas, in the New World, we had very civilized, supposedly, tribes here that practiced child sacrifice. In Exodus 21, if you turn there, I told you that as we go through this, I want to shed some light on verses in the Bible, and we'll do that. What was interesting to me as I went through some of this information is that when I was studying and reading about infanticide, it was pointed out that in ancient Egypt, not in Roman times necessarily, but in ancient Egypt, back when Israel was there and before Israel was there, infanticide was not practiced. They valued the life of children in Egypt. And, for whatever reasons, that's where God put the children of Israel for a while and then called them out of that culture. And there were a lot of wrong things with that culture, but that's one thing that was right that they took with them. So that's good. Exodus 21. In verse 22, it's talking about men striving and hurt a woman with child so that, and I got a King James here, so that her fruit depart. In other words, she has a miscarriage and no mischief, no other injuries follow. He shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him. So it doesn't call for a capital, they call it a capital offense there for whatever reason. It doesn't, but it does say that the father gets to levy a fine, a penalty, on the person that caused the injury. And that's right there in the Torah at the beginning, right after the Ten Commandments, showing that the people of Israel were told, instructed to place a value on the life of children. Now, you think, well, that should be self-evident. But as I've already pointed out to you, it's not self-evident. Because all around them, there was no value. I shouldn't say all around them. In Egypt, there was. But all around them in the rest of society, there was not a value placed on children's lives. And we know from various verses, you can look at Leviticus 18 while we're here in the Torah. Leviticus 18 and verse 21, I think. Yeah, Leviticus 18, verse 21. You shall not let any of your seed pass through the fire to Moloch. Neither will you profane the name of your Lord your God. And, you know, what's he talking about? He's talking about giving children in sacrifice. Now, I never thought about this before. And this is just one of these things when you it broadens your horizons a little bit. I thought, well, these people, they're so strange. They feel like they got to give their treasured young, you know, their baby. They just had a brand new baby, and they feel like they're obligated to give it to this God. And maybe that's true. I can't say that it's not. But studying what I studied here about infanticide and about how common it was in society, it seems even more likely that they're going to kill this kid anyway. But part of the just developed that, well, you're not just going to kill it, we'll give it to the gods. We'll make a religious ceremony out of it. But they weren't going to let it live anyway. Likely. That's my conclusion. This was a common thing. The fact that some of them sacrificed it, it was added to the pie, added to it, maybe a little bit, but they already weren't going to let these children live. Jeremiah 7. 29, where Jeremiah refers to this practice. Jeremiah 7 and verse 29. Cut off your hair, O Jerusalem, and cast it away, and take up a lamentation on the high places, for the Lord has rejected his forsaken the generation, rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, says the Lord. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it, and verse 31 says, and they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not, neither came in my heart. So apparently the God's people started copying these perverted practices that were part of the culture around them, which of course is why God had told them again and again, Don't do these things because they're evil. Don't intermarry with them. Don't mix with them because they got evil practices. But, you know, as we saw in Exodus, and we can also see in Psalm 127, which is a familiar psalm, we sing it. You know, the Jews, the Israelites, and the Jews in the time of Jesus and the apostles had a different perspective on this, and that's good. So when I'm telling you what it's like to be a woman in the time of the New Testament, in some matters, in some particulars, it mattered whether you were Jewish, whether you were Gentile or not. And this is one of them. In Psalm 127, you know it, and I'll read it anyway because it's encouraging and comforting. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman wakes, but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of his youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. So you see in the Bible here, we have a different perspective, don't we? These children are a blessing from God. And the more the better, you know, to an extent, I guess, if you take care of them. The more the merrier. It's great if you have your quiver full. They're seen as a blessing. And that's part of the heritage that I thought we had in this country, but when you think of some of the other statistics, which I won't go over again, maybe we don't. You know, some of us have that heritage, and that's good, and we're blessed that way. So, this is one of those examples that I talked to you about, that we may, because we love our children and they are precious to us, we may project that back on to society or onto other cultures in our current society today, and yet it's not true. It's not true. And it's a common practice in the world today. It was a common practice in the world then that if you didn't want children, you just got rid of them. You expose them. You set them out. And as sick as that sounds, I mean, it's like, well, you don't bear responsibility. You didn't actually kill them. You just set them outside. And I've shared this with you before probably, but maybe all of you weren't here. When I was in Thailand, and there they are, of course, Buddhists mostly, in most of the country. And there was a rat in the building where I stayed, a big one. And they needed to catch it because it was eating the food supplies or something. And they told this guy that he had to catch the rat. Well, this, you know, the guy who worked there. And he was Buddhist, and he's not going to kill that rat because that rat could be one of his relatives, or, you know, they believe in reincarnation. So they don't kill animals. And that's just the way it is. So what does he do? He's got to do something with this rat, but he can't kill it. Well, he sets a trap, which is a plate with some concoction on it, which is a combination glue and good-smelling food. And so the rat goes in there, gets caught. It's like an ant trap. You know, you get caught in the goo, and then he exposes it. He takes the rat, sits it out in the sun, and the rat dies. But he didn't kill it, did he? That's the way they look at it. Sounds silly, doesn't it? But that's exactly what they did with children back in the Roman Empire. But the person who made that decision, the father who said, you're not going to live, didn't raise that child up, he didn't take it out. Yes? Oh, I would agree with you, obviously. I'm just saying that somehow in his mind, I can't speak for him. He's a good, I liked him. I got along with him fine, but I don't know what he was thinking. I didn't ask him. Like, why can you do that to the rat, but you can't kill it, you know? Yes, he's obviously responsible, but somehow he excused himself. That was his way of getting out of it. Because he's in a rough spot. He's told to get rid of the rat, but he can't violate his conscience and kill it. So that's how he handled it. Okay, I was thinking about exposure, and I hadn't learned, I just really, this is one of those facets, maybe some of you knew about this before, it's one of those things I just never knew anything about. I never knew. And there's a lot of information out there if you want to study it more. But it reminded me of a couple things. First of all, when they would expose a child, you didn't automatically assume it was going to die. You hoped, maybe, especially if you're a mother, maybe, you hoped that it was going to be picked up. Somebody would come along, somebody would take care of it. And in fact, they had laws. I'll get into some of the laws later. They had laws that explain, what do you do if you've exposed this child, and then 20 years later, it knows who its family is, it's made it, and now, you know, there were actually laws to determine how the inheritances work, does it still have a relationship with the birth family, and it's very complicated, but that's the way it was. So you didn't automatically assume that this child was going to die. And in fact, in history, in myth, if you remember your myths, who were the founders of Rome? Romulus and Remus. And what happened to them? Raised by wolves because they were thrown into the Tiber and rescued. They were exposed. They were thrown into the river. Rescued, raised by wolves and lots of other animals and so forth. That's the story. Is there one like that in the Bible? What? Oh, not a hard, this isn't a trick question. This is a real easy one. Moses. I wasn't trying to make a hard one there. I'm not saying that, you know, that his parents were trying to expose him. That's not the point. They weren't. But they did put him out there in the water, hoping he would be rescued. That's the way it's written. And he was. Not only that, and this is also apparently true, there is some anecdotal evidence in some of those sources, that when some children were exposed and the parents didn't really want to expose them, they kind of kept an eye on them to see who took them so they could catch up with them later, just like Miriam did watching Moses, right? So, you know, know where he went and who had him. So this is just the way it was. Now, just one other point about being a child, whether you're a girl or a boy back then. Let's say you weren't exposed, or you were exposed and rescued. What do you think your odds of living past the age of 5 were? I don't, there's no accurate statistics. Anybody want to guess? There are people that make intelligent guesses.
5-0.
No, it's not that bad. 50%. Now, some of the estimates are around 50%. So that, I mean, that's how life was. Infectious diseases killed a lot of people. All kinds of things killed people. So regardless of what happened when you were born, your chances of living to be 6 were maybe 1 in 2. Now, if you're get back to being born a girl, chances are 1 in 2. What if you're a mother? And we'll talk more about motherhood later. If you're a mother, and it, again, we're sometimes, and I'm not making light of this or putting it down, we're sometimes traumatized by a miscarriage or, you know, something like that in our families. Back then, it was common. Not only was it common to have a miscarriage, it was common to die in childbirth. It was common not to live to the age of 6. Death of young mothers and their children was a normal part of life, a normal sad part of life. And again, we're reading into it a little bit here, but you read the sources, especially in Rome, and I'll get into this later when we talk about mothers, but it seemed to be more honorable, more expected to have close and well-bonded relationships with your adult children than with children that are just born. We value a newborn, especially in our society today. We give them everything. They got more toys than they know what to do with. You know, we're just maybe a little bit overboard in how we shower love and attention and things on little babies. It wasn't like that in the ancient world, because it was just a matter of fact that a large portion of them weren't going to make it, and so they seemed to honor, to a certain extent, the relationships they had with the older children, and especially in Rome. It was this stiff upper lip kind of thing where you don't grieve too much. And you can read the Maccabees, the story of the Maccabees, which is not necessarily Rome, but it's the same time frame where the mother of the children that were executed, and I think she ended up losing her life as well, but she's written and portrayed as being very stoic about it. Very, you know, you just got to do what's right and, you know, go ahead and I'll go ahead and die for your belief and I'll join you. You know, one of those kind of things. Very unmotherly like, as you know, it's almost written from a male perspective, I guess. But anyway, this just helps illustrate that there was a different mindset back then toward young children. For better, you know, you could say for better or worse, I say for worse, but that's just the way it was. Daughters were not as desired as sons, but either could be exposed. And there were no repercussions. It was just, that's what you did. You didn't feel bad about it. The Jews, however, valued their children. They had been taught from the Torah and by God to value children, and they did. And in either case, whether you valued them or didn't value them, the infant and child mortality rate was very high, and as well as a lot of mothers who died in having children. Okay. Got to start with that. I got to start with the young part. It's you don't make it to be an adult. You got to get through the youth first. Let's say you do. The next thing I want to talk about, and this is a complicated area, and I'll try not to spend too much time, but it does have some implications in the Bible, I believe, and that has to do with inheritance rights. You say, what? What about inheritance rights? It's complicated, but the bottom line was, it was very important in the Roman culture to keep track of who had what in the families and in which direction the money went. In fact, when we talk about marriage a little later, you see that that's really what mattered, is the contract that had to do with the money, not whether or not you're married or not so much. From this book on page 42, again, talking about women as daughters in that chapter. I don't know how much of this I'll read, but bear with me a little bit. Inheritance right of daughters. And the reason I want to read this and share this with you is because of verses in the Bible which seem to indicate that women mattered for some reason. And I'm giving you some evidence here of why they did. Not just mattered for their own sake, because everyone's a child of God, but they mattered in other ways as well to the ministry of Jesus and to Paul, I believe. Okay, Koch writes, not all or even most daughters were exposed. Once the father agreed to raise his daughter, Roman law allowed for her to benefit equally from her father's estate if he died intestate, if he didn't have a will. If she was married under the status of sine manu, that means, well, I'll get into that in a little bit, wherein her father retained the legal authority over her, and this was the most common instance. I should just interrupt here and explain this. The laws of in the Roman Empire, the time of Jesus and the apostles, were written in such a way that if you were married in a licit marriage, one that was recognized by the Romans because you were a citizen, that's what licit means. I told you I would explain that later, and I didn't. Illicit doesn't mean bad. It just licit in this sense means something, a marriage that's recognized by Rome because the people that are getting married are Roman citizens. If it was illicit, it just meant they weren't Roman citizens, is all. Didn't mean it was bad or illegal, just they weren't Roman citizens. And the laws didn't apply. The same laws didn't apply. But the marriages were such that the father retained control over his daughter and over her property, even though she was married. That was called sine, I can't speak Latin, but it's sine manu, with hand, without hand. The father retained legal authority over her. Then she inherited an equal share of the family estate with her brothers. Once her father died, like her brother, she was legally independent from his authority, no longer under the paterfamilias, and I haven't mentioned that, and I will. If she or her brothers were children, they were under the care of guardians. When her brothers came of age, they were released from that authority, but the girl continued under the supervision of a tutor. So there was still, you could inherit, and they had similar rights as their brothers, but not exactly the same. They still had to be represented by a male, which puts you back, I'm interrupting the book here, the quote, but that puts you back in mind of some of the things in the Old Testament, right? Where, a woman, especially a widow, for instance, a single mother, would not have a way of being represented at the gate to be heard by the elders of the town, except that some man would take her case. That's kind of the way it was. And it was still that way in Rome. And only by the time you get to Rome, it was legally that way. You had to have a man, in at least during certain periods of the empire, and for certain situations, you had to have a man take your case to court. You couldn't bring yourself. He would supervise the sale of certain types of property or slaves and approve her will. Cicero recounts a case where a woman named Valeria, the wife of Sextilius Andro, died intestate. Her husband wanted her fortune, but her guardian, Flaccus, possibly her uncle or her brother or nephew, don't know, some relative, claimed it as well. You see, she died, but she had some wealth. Why did she? Because she, well, we'll get into that too a little later, but you inherited certain of your family wealth. The women could. And then the husband had use of that. And she died without a will. The husband wanted all of her estate. But then these are actual court records that still exist. That's why we have these original sources. And then the argument goes to court. It's like, well, who has the right here? And sometimes we don't know exactly how it all turned out. But a lot of times this argument was between maybe a husband and maybe somebody who represented the family who still had some control over her. So even though you left your family, supposedly, in a way, and got married to someone else, you never really left your family, especially the women didn't. You were still part of that family. And you might, the implications are, again, we're reading between the lines, that the loyalty was more so to the family of origin than the family you married into. That seems to be the way it was. And interestingly enough, I didn't put it in my notes, but it does say in the Bible that a man leaves his father and mother, is joined unto his wife, doesn't it? That kind of reflects the way the law was. It was the father, the husband didn't get the wife's riches. He got them to use as long as she was there. And when she was gone, they went. That's how it worked. We'll get into that a little bit too. I interrupted this. I want to finish the quote. If the daughter had been emancipated by her father, he would only have the rights of the tutor, much more limited than the rights of a father. If the married daughter was a Roman citizen and had three live births, or a freedwoman needed four live births, she was released from a tutor. So if you had a tutor, but yet you had an account, you had to have these children had to be alive long enough to be named, which means about 8 days. If you had three children who lived to be 8 days old, then you could be released from the control of a tutor. I don't know what the reasoning was behind that, but that's the way the law was written. And then you can make your own financial decisions. And there are records of some of these situations. And that's how we know. A woman could loan money, take out loans. She could not guarantee a loan, though. So she had certain freedoms, and she was an important part of her family's financial situation, but those freedoms and those rights were limited to a certain extent. That's just that's the reality of the law the way it was then. So I read a bunch there, and it's kind of complicated, but it's important. And the reason it's important is because you realize that women could inherit money just like men could, and therefore they had economic power. Okay? They had economic power, though with certain restrictions. Sometimes by law, the economic influence that they had was separate, independent of their husbands. All right, Mark 15, and we could turn to any of the Gospels. It wouldn't matter which one. I'm going to turn to Mark. When Jesus was killed, who was there? Well, there were a lot of people there. But each of the four Gospels make a point of saying this. In Mark 15, verse 40, says, there were also women looking on afar off, among whom was Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the less, and of Joseph and Salome, who also, when he was in Galilee, followed him and ministered unto him, and many other women which came with him from Jerusalem. Why does it make mention of the women? I can't give you the answer there, but I will suggest to you. It says they served him. And King James says ministered. I will suggest to you that some of these women had money from their family that their husbands may not have had control over, and they helped support the ministry of Jesus and the apostles. Now, they were disciples. They were important, and they mattered as individuals, as human beings, but I think they were also supporters, some of them. And when you read the book of Acts, you see again and again there were important women. In fact, it says that in Acts 13. You know, what kind of women were these? Were they just any kind of women? No, it doesn't say that. What does it mean? Well, I'm giving you some background. You can come to your own conclusions because I can't prove it. And maybe we can't come to conclusions, but at least I can broaden your mind a little bit. You can think on a more expanded way about these verses. Acts 13 and verse 50. Now they're in Antioch, not the Antioch I spoke about before, but the one that's in Asia. And it says, the Jews stirred up the devout and honorable women. Again, I'm in the King James. And the chief men of the city. And so they stirred up some persecution. And if you have a New American Standard, anybody have a New American Standard there? Or another thing? It says, what does it say here? It says honorable women. Anybody have a different translation there?
Devout.
Oh, devout. It says devout and honorable. Okay, a different word for honorable?
Prominent.
The New American Standard says prominent. Maybe others do. Prominent. These were important women. Why were they important? Anybody want to venture a guess? It doesn't say, so it's just a guess. Money? Why? And yes, they have money. Why do they have money? They're connected to a prominent family. These were not just any women. They weren't just women that happened to be interested in the message of the gospel. They were men. They were women that mattered in the community because they were connected to families that had money and influence. And in Roman society, now here we're out in Asia now. We're in one of the provinces. We're not in Judea. In Roman society, it was very important who you were connected to. And if your family had power and influence, the kids were going to have power and influence. And it was a lot of pressure on a family to bring up the children to share in that. And that's one of the reasons apparently, why there was exposure. Why did you not want to have five kids? Well, you have to split it all up. Well, you can't make them all rich and famous. That's reading between the lines, but that's the conclusion of some historians, why you'd want to get rid of some of them, because there's a lot of pressure in Roman society. I'm not talking about Jewish society now. In Roman society, there's a lot of pressure to bring up your child to a certain standard that you enjoy, and because of your contacts and your family and your history and all and your genealogy, these kids are going to have the same opportunities you have, and you can't have 10 of them to run the town, but maybe two can. I don't know. I'm just throwing the ideas out there. Family connections and wealth. While we're in Acts chapter 17, in Acts 17, they're in Berea, right? And verse 4, some of them believed and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, a great multitude of the chief women. Here it says chief women in the King James. The chief women, quite a few. Anybody have a different translation for chief women? What do you have? Leading women, yeah. What's it mean, leading women? Are they in charge? Well, in a way, maybe they were. If they weren't in charge, they could just talk to Daddy, who was. You know, they had connections, and they had money. Verse 12, that was Thessalonica. I'm sorry. Then they're in Berea by the time you get to verse 12. Therefore, many of them believed, and also the honorable women, which were Greeks, and of men, not a few. So these are Greek. These are Gentile women. And again, because the culture was different, we're not talking about Jewish culture here. We're in the Gentile world. And so these laws that I was reading to you, they applied. You had these inheritance laws. You had these connections with the families and so forth. And you had the fact that a woman, when she got married, she was, in many cases, more loyal to the family of her birth, her family of origin, than she was to the family she married into. And actually, it was a way for men. This is what happened in Rome. It was a way, a family, I'll be back up just a little bit. You know, we have daughters and we have sons. You're rich and you're famous and you got money and you control town and you have a daughter. Okay, what's that daughter going to do? She's going to marry somebody who's ambitious, right? They're going to look for somebody that they think might work out. But also, every guy in town is thinking, I'm going to marry her. That's the only way I'm going to get anywhere. That's the way it worked. So that's why they were leading women. I think, anyway. They had connections, which gave them the money and the influence. And it doesn't say it, but it's mentioned enough times that I think you can make a good case for saying that these women supported not only Jesus, but even more so even Paul in his ministry. And they had the ability to do that, and they had the right lawfully to do that, whether their husbands cared or not, because husbands didn't have control. Philippians chapter 4, just one more while we're here. Philippians chapter 4, verse 3. I put this in here, and I don't remember why. Oh, okay. He's writing to the Philippians, and then he says in verse 3, I entreat you also, true yoke fellow, to help those women which labored with me in the gospel. So he had some that helped him in some way. Some of them, as I would be willing to argue that they helped him financially. So there were all kinds of laws regarding inheritances, divorce, death, whether you were slave and free, or you were slave, you became free. Then what happens to the inheritances? And they had all these laws to organize all this. And even concerning people who had been exposed, as I said, they had laws. What happens if you were exposed as a child? Then you live to be 20, you reach your majority, and you want to reconnect with your family, and you want to reconnect with whatever honor that they had. And there were laws that governed all that. And we have records today that sometimes there's one that's in this book, and I would not try, I couldn't understand it myself, I wouldn't try to read it to you. It just goes on and on. It sounds like a modern court case, back and forth, and the ins and the outs, and there was a divorce, and there was marriage, and there was more than one wife, and it got really complicated. But all the records are there, just like lawyers have always been good at keeping records and judges. But the bottom line is that Roman women, and in Jewish society as well, to a lesser extent, Women had some rights to control their own destiny and the use of family resources to a point. And I think, I will claim, and I just share it with you, that the early church benefited in some cases from those laws and from the generosity of these women. Okay. I want to start talking about marriage a little bit. We'll get into that. There was, you know, just like we have now, you have this pie-in-the-sky idea of what it's like to be married, what the ideal wife is, the ideal husband, the ideal family. They had the same thing then. So when you read the sources and you read somebody say this or that or the other thing, it doesn't mean necessarily that this is the way it really was, but there was an ideal anyway. And the surviving sources are fond of talking about that ideal. There was an ideal bride, the ideal wife, and often, actually, she's seen as the one who spins. And I don't mean like a, you know, like this, but she works with a spinning wheel in her house and makes wool thread and maybe makes clothes out of that. We have no idea whether how many people actually did that, but that was one of the ideals that you had. This woman, not only was she a good wife, but she made you clothes, or she would take the wool and spin it into thread in the home. Was it a reality? We don't know. But much of the surviving evidence that we have about marriage comes in the form of contracts, marriage contracts, dowry contracts, and there's a lot of that still around. I don't know how far I'll get into this. I'm going to read a little bit about the background of the period, and this comes from the book again, and we'll be talking about Aristotle, and he and Plato, Socrates, these guys had very definite ideas, right or wrong, which were part of the foundation for Greek and therefore for Roman society. And some of their ideas were actually very good, and they lived on. And I need to share some of that with you to give you some background here. It's important to, before discussing marriage, it's important to highlight two competing views of male and female, for they play a foundational role in the construction of family systems. Plato's view on men and women was grounded in his belief in reincarnation of the soul. He argued that if the soul was placed in a male or female body based on the relatives that, I'm sorry, he argued that the soul was placed in a male or female body based on its relative strength of character, with weaker souls placed in female bodies. You like that? Y'all women are fans of Plato now. This is the way it was. I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just saying this is part of the background. Aristotle, Plato's student. I skipped some stuff. I'm sorry. Through education, however, women could gain wisdom and virtue because their soul is of the same nature as a man's soul. As they move further from their matter or female mode, women progress closer to wisdom. Oh boy, that's hard to read, isn't it? The Republica. In the Republic, Plato writes that man or woman's identity comes from the mind, soul, not the body. The soul is not matter. All right, we get that soul-body duality there. By the way, at the cosmic level, form is male, active and superior. Matter is female, passive and inferior. Okay, so that whole idea that the soul, that spirit is good and flesh is bad, that Gnostic idea, the female was associated with the flesh. Sorry, that's just the way it was. Aristotle, Plato's student, rejected his views on reincarnation, believing that the soul cannot exist without the body. Moreover, Aristotle believed that the mother contributed nothing to the fetus. He sought consistency of determining sexual identity and offered the first comprehensive statement about sex polarity. Okay, I don't want to read all this, but the point is that Aristotle did believe in reincarnation, but he believed in a certain structure to society, all right, the family, I'll summarize here, the family, rightly so, is seen as the foundation or the building block of building a society. And just as society was ruled by men, the families were ruled by men, that's the way they looked at it. And yes, there was this inferiority. Women were inferior to men. Let's see, how much of this do I really want to read? The female by nature. It's different than the male, so much so that Aristotle and Zenon the Epicurean say the female is imperfect, the male, however, perfect. Yeah, you all agree with that, right? Aristotle's expectations for the morality of women's and wives differed from those concerning male virtue. Each gender has a specific attribute, and so the courage or justice of a man is different from a woman's courage. I could go on. I'm not going to read all that. Now, continuing on, perhaps, this is Koic now, perhaps not all later philosophers agree with Aristotle's classification of government leadership, but they did speak with one voice on the importance of a husband governing his wife, which served as the backbone of social stability. Like Aristotle, they understood a husband's leadership and a wife's obedience to be natural or according to nature. I'm interrupting here, but that's exactly what Paul and others said in the New Testament. So they were consistent with the general Hellenistic view of their times. And Paul and others would go to the Torah for their justification, but they came to the same conclusions. It was essential, therefore, for the state to regulate the natural order between genders and classes. Dionysus of Halicarnassus, writing in the 1st century BC, suggested that a virtuous married woman conforms obediently to the temperament of her husband, while the husband should rule his wife as an important and inseparable possession. Okay. I could have read more there. Point is that Aristotle's philosophy had to do with a certain structure to society that began in the family. We kind of feel the same way today. I mean, it takes a village, all these kind of things. You start with a family as a building block of society. That's an old concept, and it's not necessarily wrong. But it does show, and this carried on, Aristotle's long before Christ, but these ideas carried on into that society, and there was an expectation that families would be run in a certain way, and there was an expectation that society would be run in a certain way. In fact, if you want to look at the book of Esther, or you're familiar with the story, you don't need to turn there, but you remember the story of Vashti and the king in Esther chapter 1, if I can find it, where they're having this big party and a feast, and she was supposed to parade her beauty before everybody, and she didn't. She refused the request of the king. And what was the problem with that, the problem was, according to the king's counselors, if I get there, they said, what are we going to do to Vashti? Because she has not performed the commandment of the king. And then somebody answered and said, Vashti the queen has not done wrong to the king only, but also to the princes and all the people that are in all the provinces. For if this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto the women, so shall they won't despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported, because the king commanded her to come and she didn't come. In verse 18, verse 22, the command went out. He was sent letters to all the king's provinces, to every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own home, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. So there was an expectation in society, and whoever wrote the book of Esther had that same expectation, and it was written as being the expectation of the people in Persia. Marriage was firstly, for what it's worth, and I heard this. I remember hearing this in the church when I was probably 21 years old, 22 years old, right after I got out of college. I remember somebody saying this and a sermon or a Bible study. Marriage was firstly a contract between families. Well, this person said it was a business arrangement, is what he said. Marriage was firstly a contract between families that sought to preserve or extend each family's influence, wealth, and standing. Just like I was just telling you. Those are my words. you sought an arrangement with another family that would either preserve your own status you already had or perhaps increase your status. So it's important to you who your kids married because of that. And the laws that we have are these contracts that have to do with the money that gets transferred and how it gets transferred and the rules about it. The fact that, again, it's easy to be anachronistic here. What do? We have a big wedding. We have a ceremony. We have a minister, somebody that has a certificate like I have, and I'm legalized by the state to sign a certificate that says these two people are married, and I've done that. There was nothing like that back then. So for us to put our current system and our current way of doing things and project it back on that time is not wise, because it wasn't like that at all. People were married then because they said, what did they say? We're married. We're going to live together. We're going to raise a family. That's what it was. The only thing that was legal about it is if you were a licit marriage, that is, you were Roman citizens, you had a contract that said this dowry is handled in this way and so forth. And if you're divorced, this happens. If you die, you know, it has all the ins and outs. It was a contract. There were many laws that governed the arrangement, but in principle, there was no difference among the Jews. It was pretty similar. Their marriages were not licit in general, though, because most of them were not citizens. So they could do what they wanted, and they weren't bound by the laws of the Roman Empire on that were for licit marriages, ones that were recognized in the eyes of the state. Some of these things I've already said, so I'm going to skip down. You know, if you're a woman again, your security probably, in more cases than not, is going to depend more on the family you were born in than on the family you married into. You're going to rely on your dad or on your mom or whoever else is, your brothers, whoever is handling the state if your father had died. And remember, not only was child mortality high, I haven't mentioned this yet, but mortality in general was high. If you were a woman, I don't have it here. Maybe I'll read it next time. There were women sometimes that were in their 20s that already had 4, 5, 6 births, half of whom had died and maybe lost a husband or two by then. That's the way the world was, and we have records of it. And likewise, there were men that lost wives. Not that it was more dangerous to be a woman than a man. Men had the more accidental type deaths, but women would die in childbirth. So anyway, mortality was high. And that's one of the reasons it was important to have these laws, because your inheritance, your dowry, whatever, it could go through different stages as you went through different stages of your life, married to different people because of death and all these kinds of things. So it got complicated. And maybe because of all of that, one of the things that never changes is your daddy's your daddy, your family's your family. And so your loyalty as a woman often was more to your family, because that was sure and that would never change. The husband, and he was called the paterfamilias, that's the idea. He was the man in charge of the family. Okay, he was seen as responsible for managing the entire household, as Aristotle would have said. Within this structure, though, the wife also had responsibility for managing the household. And if we'll turn to a couple more scriptures, and I guess that'll be it. In 1 Timothy, you're probably familiar with these. 1 Timothy. Now, there's different words used here, but the general meaning is about the same. It talks about, I got to get to 1 Timothy first. 1 Timothy chapter 3, talking about leaders in the church. And in verse 4, it says, "He that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity, rules." Okay, there's a word there for rule. It's piestemi. It means to manage or rule. That's repeated in verse 5, I think. No, it's not. That is verse. Yeah, it is repeated in verse 5. If man know not how to rule his own house, again, I'm in the King James. And in verse 12, it says, "Let the deacons be the husband of one wife, ruling their children." The same word. Now, it's a different word, but the kind of the same meaning in 1 Timothy chapter 5. And verse 14, "I will therefore that the younger women marry." Now, this is talking about a widow. And I didn't have that in my notes, but I should go back. We should cover this. Verse 11, "But the younger widows refuse." This is to be in the care of what we would call third tithe, or the church being caring for these people, and these are older women who are going to pray and serve in the church. And he's saying, don't bring young widows into this number, because they can get married again. And just to make a point, verse 11, that now should be clearer to you. Why go to the trouble to explain what a young widow should do? That would seem like in our time to be a rare occurrence that you wouldn't have to put into a general letter to a church or to a church leader. But see, it wasn't a rare occasion back then that a woman lost her husband. It happened all the time, and there were lots of young widows. And so it was an important thing to know what to do about these women. You know, do we include them in this other group or not, and so forth. But anyway, it says in verse 14, I wish that they would marry and bear children and guide the house. Oh, so they have management responsibility also. So that was in the Jewish system as well as in the Roman system, that, you know, there's this idea of managing the affairs of the family, and it involved both the husband and the wife. Even though they had this negative opinion of women and their intelligence, in the end, they thought that the women should have this responsibility in the family. Augustus' reign, he was the first, Augustus Caesar was the first real Roman emperor. I mean, you had Julius Caesar, and then you had people, he was killed because he, you know, that you had the Republic before, which was supposedly somehow to one extent or another democratic, and the Senate picked the leaders. Then you had Augustus, who established himself as an emperor, and we're going to worship Julius Caesar, and we're going to worship the emperor, and we're going to worship these people. So the nature of governing in the Roman world became different, and now we're talking about the empire. And this happened right before the time of Jesus. All right, this is when we're getting to the time of empire. And under Augustus, for whatever reasons, and they argue about what the reasons are, we got all these laws about what happens to the dowry, these laws about what happens to the inheritance, laws about marriage, laws about divorce, law, 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 law. Some people say it was Augustus just trying to grab some virtue from Roman history and identify himself with it as a man who stands for traditional family values. And maybe it was, you know, I don't know. He was in a little bit of a battle with the Roman Senate, and they weren't exactly paragons of virtue, so he knew how to arouse some populist sentiment, and he was doing it. Don't know all the reasons, but anyway, there was a flurry of laws under Augustus that had to do with control or managing and ruling on families type situations. And the Jewish writings, for the most part, seem to not take issue with these laws. They seem to fall into line. Not 100%, not all the time, but in general, they fell into line with them. But not all, like I said, not always. We'll go into some differences next time. I think I'll wrap up now. There's more to cover on marriage law, on Jewish marriage as opposed to Roman marriages in general. And we'll talk about motherhood also. And we'll probably next time continue past motherhood into learning a little bit about the religious activities of the average woman in the New Testament. So we'll pick up where we dropped off, which is in the middle of marriage, but we'll begin to talk next time about some of the differences between the Jewish ideas of marriage and Roman ideas of marriage and how it actually came down in practice.